So every year in January, our Board of Elders gathers together for our annual retreat. We've met over the years in some really exotic places like the St. Louis Campground, Alma College, and right here in this very sanctuary. And every year, our Board of Elders gathers together to meet and to evaluate how things are going in the life of the church and to look in new directions of where things might need to be going, where things might need to be headed. These are sometimes significant shifts in the movement of the church. And it is something like an annual meeting that is taking place this morning in the ancient town of Ramah. The elders of Israel are gathered together with Samuel, who has been their leader now for several decades, and no doubt they are gathered together at an important convention center in the Ramah Da Inn. And if you look carefully this morning, you're going to notice that Samuel is on the hot spot. He's gathered with all the elders of Israel, and Samuel is in the hot spot. Now, a word about Samuel. We met him last Sunday morning. We learned last Sunday morning that he was the son of Hannah, the long-awaited son of Hannah, that she had prayed ardently for the Lord to grant her a son, and the Lord had answered her prayer. And last Sunday, we met Samuel at the time that he was dedicated in the sanctuary in Shiloh. He is an old man now, as we meet him this morning. His hair is graying, what he has left, and his back is stooped, and his eyes are tired. And Samuel is seated with the elders of Israel, and for decades, he has been arguably Israel's greatest leader to date. He has been extraordinary. He has been a prophet. He has spoken on behalf of God on a number of occasions. He's led Israel as they have overcome the tyrannies of the Philistines and the Amorites. Samuel has done something that few leaders in Israel have been ever able to do, and that is he has helped the 12 tribes of Israel to be distinctive, to reflect the character of God in their world. Under Samuel's leadership, Israel has stood out and been different than the nations that surround them, with the exception of an occasional Canadian accent that slips in, eh? Other than that, Samuel has led these people to be distinctive, God's people, reflecting God's own character in the world, but all that's about to change. This is a fateful moment in the life of Israel that we are observing this morning. What you need to know about Samuel, one more thing, is that Samuel is not a king. And he's always been very clear about this. Samuel is not a king. And if the people had asked him to be the king, Samuel would have said, no, you don't need me to be a king because you have a king already. Your king is Yahweh, or Jehovah, as we referred to him in the song this morning, God the creator and the redeemer who led us out of Israel and captivity and has set us free. You don't need a king, Samuel would have said to the people. But this particular morning, the elders of Israel are putting Samuel on the hot spot and things are about to change. And they, having taken some classes in diplomacy, they look at Samuel and they say, Samuel, you're old. Remember, diplomacy, you're old. And your sons are not worth a plug nickel. Your sons could screw up a train wreck, Samuel. They're worth absolutely nothing. And so we want you to select for us a king, like all the other nations have. This is a key phrase, by the way. We want you to select for us a king so that we can be like the nations. It is a tragic moment in Israel's history that is taking place right now that we're observing. It is a tragic moment. Samuel retreats from this place. This is a man you need to understand who has not just been a man of action through his life. He is also a man who has returned over and over and over again to the sanctuary of his soul to listen to God the Creator. And that's what he does again this morning. He retreats to the place of prayer. And there in prayer, the Lord says to Samuel, look, don't take this personally, Samuel, because it's not you that they're rejecting, it's me. They've been rejecting me since the time that I led them out of Egypt and out of slavery, and they're rejecting me again. Samuel, give them what they want. Go back and give the people what they want, only warn them. Tell them that if they take a king, they're going to pay the price that you take when you take a king. Their sons will be inscripted to fight in the king's wars. Their daughters will be inscripted to serve menial tasks in the king's palace. They're going to be weighted down with a load of taxes that they can hardly even imagine today. Their backs will be broken by the weight of taxes that they're going to pay. Tell them that if they want a king, that that's what they're going to get. And this story comes to its completion in this reading of the text this morning with the horrific words that Israel moves forward with their choice to reject God as their king. I'm curious. Does any of that sound familiar to you today? This notion of rejecting God as king, does any of this sound familiar to you? Does this sound familiar to anybody? We want to be like the nations. Paraphrase it just a little bit. I don't know very many people who go around saying we want to be like the Canadians and we want to be like Mexico or any other foreign country bordering the United States like California. I don't know anybody that says that, but paraphrase this just a little bit. We want to be like the world. We're tired of reflecting the character of God to the world, being a unique, different, set-apart people. We'd like to just blend in a little bit more. Does that sound familiar to any of you? I remember this friend of mine that I had when I was in seminary, a very, very neat lady. I remember this really surprising conversation that I had with her one day. This lady, you need to understand, was in many ways an exemplary Christian. She was generous with her time and with her money. She was sacrificial in the life she lived. She was giving all the time. And that's what made me so surprised the day she said to me, "I'm not sure this is worth it. I'm tired. I'm not sure that it's worth it to be sacrificing and giving and looking out for my neighbor." She was going through a very dark season in her life, and she said, "Sometimes I wonder if it wouldn't be better to just give in." Have you ever thought that? You see, the truth is, living as a Christian brings a whole new set of challenges to our lives. There are some people who they might say something like, "I want to be a Christian because I want the promise of eternal life." Wonderful. People might say things like, "I want to be a follower of Jesus because I want to know that God cares for all of my needs." Wonderful. Somebody might say, "I want to be a Christian because I want to know that God loves me all of the time. All of this is true." And then somebody, based on things like that, might say, "I want to be a Christian because I want my life to be easier." Not so. "I want to be a Christian because I want to know that God will take care of all of my problems." Not so sure about that. "I want to be a Christian because I want to know that no harm could ever come to me or the people that I care most about." Sorry. I want to remind you of some of the things that Jesus had to say about being his follower. One day, while Jesus was teaching his disciples and addressing a certain person in particular, Jesus said, "I need to tell you all that it would be easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, that's hard. As somebody, some Bible commentator has quipped, "A camel can indeed get through the eye of a needle. It will be rather hard on the camel." This is not easy stuff. Living as a Christian brings a whole new set of challenges. Somebody came up to Jesus one day, no doubt very exuberant and excited, came up to Jesus one day and he said, "Lord, I'll follow you anywhere." And Jesus said, "I need to let you know that foxes have their holes and the birds of the air have their nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." In other words, if I may paraphrase, if you're looking for comfort, if you're looking for ease, if you're looking for something that won't cost you very much, I recommend that you find somebody else to follow, because if you follow me, there is a sense in which in this world, as it is today, you're always going to feel a little bit homeless. That's my paraphrase of Jesus' words. Living as a Christian Living as a follower of Jesus requires you and I to look out for our world neighbor. It requires it. This is not optional. Jesus said that there are two commandments that are the summation of all of the law and the prophets. Here they are. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your mind, all of your strength, and, you know this, love your neighbor as yourself. And if any of you are like me and you've spent a whole lot of your life living in a world that is as narrow as the tiny wedge around a closed door, and that narrow, tiny wedge around the closed door in which you have lived is me, myself, and I. These are stunning words. The poor are our neighbors. The blind are our neighbors. The least of these are our neighbors. And you can't live Christianly if your heart is not open and your eyes are not open to your world neighbors. This is Jesus speaking these words, not these exact words. Jesus offering this idea, not just me. I might like a little good, work that I do from time to time, some good deeds that I do that pad my resume, but that's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is talking about love your neighbor. You see, in a lot of ways, being a follower of Jesus is harder, not easier, than not following him. So is there a piece of you that can appreciate the elders of Israel that are gathered around this morning with Sam and have put him on the hot seat, and they say to him, we want you to give us a king. We want to be like the nations. And God whispers back to Samuel. It's not you that they're rejecting, Samuel. It's me. But let me pause now to talk about the rest of the story, with all due apologies to Paul Harvey, to those of you who remember him. See, the truth is, I could tell you that this story this morning ends badly. It would be easy to end the story at a certain place and say that this story ends very badly. I could tell you that the elders of Israel rejected Samuel's warning, and they did. I could tell you that as a result of this, everything that was predicted by Samuel, by God through Samuel, in fact comes true. I could tell you that there's going to come a time when kings are going to inscript the sons of Israel into their sometimes ill-chosen wars. I could tell you that their daughters are going to serve in menial ways in the king's palaces. I could tell you that they're going to be taxed on certain occasions in ways that make the whole nation suffer. All of this is true. I could stop the story right there. I could even go on and I could tell you that as a result of sometimes ridiculous decisions and lifestyles of these kings, Israel is going to experience a civil war and they're going to split right down the middle. There's going to become a northern kingdom, Israel, and a southern kingdom, Judah, because of the poor, poor, poor governance of these kings. I could tell you that the day is going to come when the northern kingdom of Israel is going to be taken into exile, and it's going to be just like when they were taken into Egypt in slavery. And then at a later time, I could tell you that the southern kingdom is also going to go into exile, and it's going to be just like when they were taken into Egypt in slavery. I could tell you that because of everything that Samuel predicts today and the decision that Israel makes, that everything ends badly. But that would not be to tell you the rest of the story. Because the rest of the story is that even though Israel rejects God as their king, in mercy and in love, God continues to pursue them and us. You see, the story doesn't end with Samuel. The story continues. The story continues with people like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, who in different times and in different settings, in different places, say almost exactly the same thing. There's going to come a day when Jeremiah and Ezekiel are going to stand before Israel, and they're going to announce, the time is coming when I'm going to grant a new covenant to my people Israel. And on that day, the law is no longer going to be written on tablets of stone. On that day, I'm going to engraft my values and purposes on your hearts. You see, that's the way this story continues. The rest of the story includes prophets like Isaiah. In one of Israel's darkest days, God speaking through Isaiah is going to say, pretty soon, they're not going to call you deserted any longer. And pretty soon, they're not going to name your land desolate anymore. But you're going to be called, your new name, Israel, is going to be called, God's Delight is in You. And your land is going to be called Beulah. And if any of you remember the old songs about Beulah land, if you ever wonder what that means, it means married. Because the Lord is going to take delight in you, and your land will be married. As a young man marries a maiden, so will your Creator marry you. As a bridegroom rejoices over her bride, so will your God rejoice over you. You see, this is the rest of the story. The rest of the story is God's irrepressible, ardent pursuit of God's people Israel and us in mercy and love, and you can't stop it. The rest of the story includes the appearance of the king. That's incredible. We've sung about it this morning. The rest of the story includes the appearance of the king. God in Jesus Christ drawing right smack dab into the center of this crazy world and announcing, anybody remember his message? Jesus Christ announcing that the time of the reign of God has come. You see, in Samuel's day, they rejected the kingship of God. And Jesus is showing up in his day and saying, sorry, you tried to reject God's kingship, but God hasn't given up. And the time of God's reign is breaking out among you right now. The rest of the story is that God, your king, is right here in your midst. And Jesus speaking these words that are breathtaking in their power and in their beauty. Hey, follow me. Stop doing what you've been doing, living in the ways that you've been doing. Stand up and move in a different direction and follow me. And oh, by the way that I'm going is going to be gathering up those who are lost. And the way that I'm going is going to gather up those who are poor. And the way that I'm going is to be gathering up those who are broken. I'm going to be taking up the widows and the orphans, and I'm going to be fulfilling all of the promises that God has been making through all of the prophets, through all of the days, up until right now. And Jesus is going to say, if any of you are tired, come follow me. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. See, the rest of the story is that even though we've all rejected God, is there anyone here who is of whom that is not true? The rest of the story is that even though every one of us here have rejected God, the living God has never given up in his pursuit of us. Ardent, irrepressible is the reign of God. Friends, the truth is that every one of us here is going to put a crown on someone or something. We all are. Every last one of us is going to anoint someone or something king. Some of us are going to anoint greed as king. Some of us are going to anoint lust as king. Some of us are going to anoint whatever it is that happens to be working in our lives as king at that particular time. The problem with the kings that we anoint is that eventually they all come to rule over us in ways that make us slaves. But the kingship of God will set us free. And all of us are going to anoint something or someone as king. And it is Jesus' invitation, follow me, that is an invitation to anoint God as our king once again. I want to tell you a little story about a church in Indianapolis that I've become aware of. This is a fascinating little story. This little Methodist church in downtown Indianapolis was doing what a lot of churches in America are doing right now, is getting smaller, and it was decaying, and its building was wearing down, and they were having all kinds of trouble in their community. And something happened here just a handful of years ago, just fairly recently, that this church caught a new vision. They decided that if they're in the downtown area of Indianapolis, why not make a difference? So they started going out into their neighborhood and they started interviewing people. And they weren't the kind of interviews that you might imagine. What is it that we can do for you? How could we make your life more comfortable? This church in Indianapolis started going out to their neighbors, many of whom didn't go to church and they didn't know. They started going out to their neighbors and saying, how would you like to use your gifts to bring renewal in this community? They said, our church wants to be in this community to be about renewal in downtown Indianapolis. We want to make a difference here. We want to be here in such a way that the poor are empowered to take responsibility for their lives and widows and orphans are cared for. And so they went out to people in their neighborhood and they said, what are your gifts and your skills and your abilities that you would like to join together with other people to make a difference in this community? And so this little church has become this hub of networking. People with all kinds of different gifts and talents are meeting in this church. Some of them don't even worship there. Some of them don't even go to church anywhere. But they're meeting in this church with other people with similar interests and gifts. And those folks are using their gifts to make a difference in the city of Indianapolis. Here's what I love about that story. Here's what I absolutely love about it. This is a church that has caught a vision of what happens when God is our king. And we follow together under the kingship of God who is granting life. I love that story. I love that story because we are a downtown church too. And I love that story because we're a church that's catching a vision, I believe has been catching a vision for a very long time. What happens when you surrender to God as the living king? Not to this or that or that or that. What happens when you don't worry about blending in with the world? What happens when you're content to stand out and be different? You see, the Christian life is really the life of yielding to a new power. We have all yielded to an old power of sin. All of us have. We know it. Every one of us here has, at one point or another, rejected God as king, and we've been content to become like the nations, to blend in with others. We've all pulled backwards into our smallest and, may I say, least human selves at one time or another. This life of yielding to sin lives by such a narrow vision. Me, myself, the people that I care most about, and then forget about everything else. The truth is that for thousands of years, human beings have lived enslaved to our fight and flight impulses, enslaved to our knee-jerk reactions and our quick fixes. But, the Christian life is the patient life. Learning to yield to our Creator, our Lover, our Redeemer, our Friend, returning frequently to the sanctuary of this congregation and returning frequently to the sanctuary of the soul, where we learn again what it is to yield to the power of love and yield to the power of life. This is what Paul told the Christians in Rome the Christian life is all about. It's all about learning to yield to the power of God's Spirit that gives life, rather than yielding to the power of sin that brings death. Yield to Him now. Yield to Him now. You have to yield to something. Yield to Him now. Is it going to cost you something to yield to the God and Father of Jesus Christ to unreservedly say, yes, work in and with and through me? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's going to cost something for the sick to become whole. Yield to Him. It's going to cost something for your self-centered and self-indulgent life to begin to see and notice and care about your neighbor. But yield to Him. It's going to cost something to lift your eyes to the creation which is loved by the Creator and to care for it and to be a steward of it. It's going to cost something, but yield to Him. Yield to Him now. Yield to Him now. It's costly to yield to the power of life. But folks, it's nothing compared to the cost of yielding to the power of sin and death. It's costly, but it is yielding to love and yielding to righteousness and yielding to holiness and yielding to goodness. And that's what I want to invite you to do right now. We're going to sing a beautiful, beautiful song called the Revelation Song here in just a second. And as we do, I want to just invite you to yield to the power of God at work in you. There are a variety of ways that you can do that. You can go to some stations that we have over here, the prayer stations. You can write out your prayer request, and our pastors are going to be praying for you, and our intercessors are going to be praying for you later this week. If you want to come to these altars and just kneel and yield in these places of prayer, you're welcome to do that as well. Or you can stand right where you are, and in the place where you are right now, let this be a moment in the inner sanctuary of your soul where you're yielding to the one who grants life. Friends, would you stand together and let's respond to the invitation of God through our Lord Jesus.